Imagine being in your 30s or 40s and writing a letter to your 20-year-old self. What would you say? That's what Cassie Bourne requested on her blog. She's a 22-year-old college student and single mom, and she needed advice, so she asked some of her older fellow bloggers to write letters to themselves when they were in their 20s. And here are some of the responses that she got. Sarah Brown wrote, "First of all, let's get this out of the way. No, you are not crazy. Yes, you should probably talk to someone. There's no shame in that. You should also get outside more." And this from Jessica Gottlieb. "You're going to meet a really nice guy who's going to take you helicopter skiing and send you mountains of flowers. He is bad news. Trust your instincts." Cassie Bourne is the woman who started this letter project, and she joins us now from Davenport, Iowa. Welcome, Cassie.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, where did you get this idea that you wanted to turn to some of your fellow bloggers who are a little bit longer in years and ask for their advice?
Well, I actually started blogging a couple years ago, and I had traveled around to a lot of conferences and met a lot of really great women. And in our conversations, I always picked their brains about what I should be doing. And I wanted to find a way to take all of the great stories that I had collected and be able to share them with other women my age and to give them the access to that advice.
You know, some of them are unvarnished.
Yes.
I'm looking at a letter from Jen. "First of all, that guy you're dating, you're not going to marry him, in spite of the fact that you'll get engaged to him in about a year. I know it's nice to have something to fall back on while you're away at college, but once you get back to Houston, you won't be able to date any stoner snowboarding guy, so you might as well get it out of your system now."
Yes, a lot of them are very honest, and what I found about those specific stories is, you know, that when she was in that moment and when she was trying to decide what to do, it was such a big deal and such a big decision. And to be able to look back on that and say, hey, you made a mistake. It's not a big deal. Everything turns out okay. And that message is so encouraging to hear. Like, you know, these big things that are in your face that you're so scared of, in 10 years, you're going to be laughing about that same thing.
You know, this is a great idea for collecting advice. It's almost like collecting recipes. So if you had sort of a Rolodex of great advice that you got through all these letters, do me a favor and sort of tick through it. Just pull out various cards and tell me what you've learned.
I have learned to appreciate myself more, both my body and the kind of person that I am, and those things in your personality that might be a little quirky or a little odd or might make you seem a little dorky are actually, you know, they're there for a reason. And in 10 years, you may figure out what that reason is. I've learned to take myself less seriously, not worry about where I'm going and what I'm going to accomplish and focusing in on the fact that I'm 20 years old and you have to enjoy this time because it's only here for so long. I've learned a lot about how quickly things change and just realizing that wherever you are in your life right now, you're not going to be there forever. And I think that was the biggest lesson. It's so easy to get caught up in what's happening today and what's happening this week. But in 5 years, you're probably not going to remember today or this week. So just do the best that you can and enjoy the moments that you have.
Why do you think so many people actually wrote these letters to their younger selves?
I think that especially in women, there's this desire to support each other. And a lot of people wrote me and said, this was so therapeutic to look back at what I was doing in my 20s that I realized maybe I hadn't forgiven myself for. And in writing this letter, it was almost like a closure of I know you made mistakes. I know your 20s were hard, but things are good now. And I'm going to let this part of my life go and just close that era.
Cassie Bourne works in social media, and she blogs at her own site. It's called CassieBourne.com. That's B-O-O-R-N. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we also want to invite you to share your letters to your 20-something selves. You can do that at our website. That's NPR.org. Get busy.
More All Things Considered right after this.
Larry King has been a primetime fixture for the past quarter century on CNN. Last night, though, he told viewers he's going to retire from his nightly show this fall. King's ratings had flagged in recent years, but as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, his departure will still leave a big gap.
Larry King has been married 8 times to 7 women, but he has been most notably wedded to cable news pioneer CNN. And you could just hear the regret in his voice last night.
Good evening. Before I start the show tonight, I want to share some personal news with you.
Early on, his CNN show relied on friends, such as Jackie Gleason, Frank Sinatra, and Nancy Reagan. Larry King Live became a home for some serious discussion of world affairs with presidents, diplomats, and experts, and for a lot of minor celebrity scandals. Over time, Larry King Live became a vital stop on contrition tours and book junkets. Here, he pressed former President Bill Clinton to talk about his affair with Monica Lewinsky.
He did it because it was there. A lot of people... I think we need some elaboration because people
are taking that wrongly.
Wrongly.
I think
what
everybody, everybody who reads it in the book will see that I was rebuking myself.
King never placed much value on preparing for his shows. In 2006, he described for me the technique he honed during years on local radio.
There was nothing prearranged. It was totally off the top and off the cuff. And my style would be I ask short questions. I rarely ask a two-sentence question.
Last night, he looked back.
I'm incredibly proud that we recently made the Guinness Book of World Records for having the longest-running show, the same host in the same time slot, on the same network.
Yet ratings at CNN have dropped sharply across the board. Former 8 p.m. anchor Campbell Brown recently quit, saying she could not beat the ideological and bombastic appeals of Keith Olbermann of MSNBC and Bill O'Reilly of Fox News. NBC News president Steve Capus oversees MSNBC. He says CNN's flagging fortunes mark a real shift.
If you think about what's going on in our world right now, everything from wars on a couple of different fronts, a recession, the absolute disaster down in the Gulf, this is a time when traditionally CNN would have been cleaning up. Now what we see is the audience is not going to them.
King's own ratings are at record lows. Some television executives thought the 76-year-old King had lost focus and should have already been eased out. But Jonathan Klein, president of CNN's domestic network, tells NPR that King simply looked back at his tenure and made his own call.
And we do take a long view here, and we don't make knee-jerk decisions, especially about somebody who is an icon based on a few months' worth of ratings. That would be ludicrous.
Yet Klein acknowledges CNN now has the chance to reinvent its nightly lineup.
We all have to evolve, but what we will always strive to be known for is real reporting, incisive analysis, and informed opinion.
Campbell Brown will be replaced at 8 p.m. by the crusading and disgraced former Democratic governor Elliot Spitzer. He'll be paired with the Pulitzer Prize-winning conservative columnist Kathleen Parker. As for King, he says he'll continue until this fall and then appear periodically on the network. No replacement has been named, but King says he's pulling for another radio host, Ryan Seacrest of American Idol. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
When CNN's Larry King announced last night that he would retire, it solved one headache for the struggling cable news giant, but it created another. NPR's David Folkenflik offers his take on the stakes for CNN.
CNN executives say in spite of declining ratings for King and for the whole network, they're making plenty of money. But the chess pieces sure have been moving about the board with alacrity. Lou Dobbs left last fall, Campbell Brown last month, and now Larry King. That had been CNN's entire lineup from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Jonathan Klein is the president of CNN's American Network. He says King's replacement should
be intelligent, it be informed, it be surprising. The best interviews take you places that you never knew existed with people you thought you knew, but it turns out you didn't.
Campbell Brown was relatively new to CNN, but asked to get out of her contract, saying she couldn't win against the opinion-driven shows of Keith Olbermann on MSNBC and Bill O'Reilly on Fox News. Political anchor John King hasn't been a big ratings winning either in replacing the bombastic Lou Dobbs.
You don't want to just sit here and do on one hand and on the other hand, which seems to be kind of the game that CNN is doing right now. And it feels, frankly, a little tired.
Steve Capus is president of NBC News, and in that role, he oversees cable news rival MSNBC. The runaway ratings leader, of course, is Fox News, with its largely conservative primetime shows. But MSNBC's embrace of political talk by day and a left-leaning primetime lineup has paid off. Steve Kappas.
All day long now, audiences are coming to MSNBC that used to go elsewhere. They used to go to CNN. This is one of the busiest news cycles we've ever seen. And MSNBC, day in and day out, is winning.
When Lou Dobbs left CNN, it seemed to clarify the network's position, reporting over opinion. Now, CNN's John Klein puts it slightly differently.
What we will always strive to be known for is real reporting, incisive analysis, and informed opinion.
At 8 p.m., CNN is pairing the disgraced former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, a liberal crusader, with the conservative Pulitzer-winning columnist Kathleen Parker. It's an echo of the political debate show Crossfire, a show Klein killed 5 years ago. This time, he promises, the effect will be different. But now, Klein has to fill the 9 p.m. slot, too. More pieces to chase about the board. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR. How do you photograph memory? Photographer Jennifer Carotti is trying to do it. Her latest endeavor is to capture how memories of war continue to live with veterans who've returned home. A photo series, In Country, Soldiers' Stories from Iraq and Afghanistan, is now on display at SF Camera Works in San Francisco. But as NPR's Claire O'Neill reports, the intersection of art and war can be difficult territory.
We've lost our friends, our comrades, our loved ones, and you come back, and it's just as if that never happened.
Starlin Lara brought home a memory that intrigued photographer Jennifer Carotti. In Carotti's photo, Lara is bolt upright in bed, as if waking from a nightmare. The room around her is completely scorched, but she's fully clad in uniform, and a giant pink rabbit looms in the background. It's meant to give voice to the recurring nightmare she's had since surviving a roadside bomb in Iraq.
It's hard to just say, you know, hey, I'm still mourning. I'm still hurting over this. This is still really sad for me. But you just pick up and you just move on. And then you just suppress and you suppress.
Lara is not alone in that experience. The photo series starts with Mike Sprouse. He's standing on the side of a road in suburban Virginia. It looks like one of those eerily quiet summer afternoons, saturated with color. His pristine pickup truck is pulled over in this Rockwellian neighborhood of little houses and manicured lawns. But he's in full army uniform, staring at a tire with wires coming out of it. And suddenly, it's obvious. He thought that tire was an IED, an improvised explosive device. The photo symbolizes how Sprouse is living in two worlds. Physically, he's in suburban America, but his mind and reflexes are still in Afghanistan. That's what Karate wanted to show.
To give the viewer a glimpse into maybe what's going on in the veteran's head and what it's like to come home with this memory and that it lives with you, even though you're back here in the civilian world, it's there in that person's mind and manifesting itself in specific ways.
Karate thought her style of photography might be a good way to tell the veteran's stories visually.
I think this project is really a hybrid of a lot of different things. There's a slightly journalistic quality to it. Then there's the fine art, kind of a visual interpretation of the story. And then I'm also kind of inspired by the history of staged narrative tableau painting, which sometimes defies category a little bit.
Her style is probably closer to Renaissance portraiture than documentary photography in the way the photos are posed. Before 2004, her work had nothing to do with war. But in following the news of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Karate says she was particularly compelled by the veterans' first-person narratives. And that's what she's trying to capture in this series, how the sound of a Brooklyn dump truck, for example, can bring a veteran back to a mortar explosion. In a sense, it almost seems therapeutic. But then, why are the photos so abstract and artsy? Is this really about the vets? Is it art? Is it an anti-war message?
What I sense are different vectors.
Philip Kennicott, culture critic at The Washington Post, says the more you look at these photos, the more Karate's artistic style almost eclipses the stories.
And when the vector of art is becoming more prominent, I begin to worry about the soldiers. I begin to think, well, are they being manipulated? Are they being staged by this photographer? On the other hand, the soldier stories, which are printed next to or beneath the images, when those take precedence, I begin to think, well, what about the art? Why is this an art project? You know, the account of the soldier's experience is self-sufficient and emotionally powerful, and maybe we don't even need the art.
But exhibition curator Chuck Mobley says politics and style are irrelevant. This is about getting people to talk.
The fact remains that there are veterans coming back every day with these memories and with these experiences that color their life. And they're being so generous as to share that with other people so that we can sort of have some kind of understanding, as removed or as abstract as it might be, I think is really important. It's sort of like getting a peek behind the curtain a little bit.
What's behind the curtain is a person, says veteran Starlin Lara. That's what she says the series is about.
It helps to put the viewer in the mindset that, wow, you know, she's still a person. She's someone who has experienced some very extreme events, but she's still just a person and also a soldier.
In hindsight, it's the stories that stick with you. Critic Philip Kennicott says photographer Jennifer Karate's series may not be art capital A, but it's onto something.
I do think that one or two of these images are good both as art and as statements about war, because they capture a mood of isolation and they capture a mood of fear and anxiety in the midst of an absolutely normal image of America. And that's a powerful thing to do. It reminds those of us who are not in the war zone or haven't been to the war zone to look and think differently about the people who've come back from it. That's worth something. That's not a negligible accomplishment.
I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't think that it was going to do some good somehow.
Whether or not Jennifer Karate's work is therapeutic, whether or not art can be reconciled with war, it has sparked conversation, gotten veterans to tell their difficult stories, and gotten the civilian world, at least those who have seen the photos, to visualize the unimaginable. Claire O'Neill, NPR News.
Our Picture Show blog has some of Jennifer Karate's portraits of veterans. Go see them on our site, npr.org.